If you use cannabis every day, there is a very good chance your brain is actively deleting its own receptors just to survive the chemical flood.
Yeah, literally pulling them away.
Right. Meanwhile, a single dose of magic mushrooms physically forces your brain to grow brand new neural branches overnight.
It's incredible to actually see it under a microscope.
So today we are dismantling a massive cultural myth. Because if I asked you to name a natural mind-altering plant, you would almost inevitably name cannabis or psilocybin.
Right, they're the big two.
Exactly. And because they both come from the earth and they are both, riding this big wave of decriminalization right now, human nature is to just lump them together as these pharmacological cousins.
It is an incredibly pervasive assumption, too. I mean, you walk into certain wellness circles and they are tossed into the exact same mental bucket labeled like natural plant medicine.
Right.
But from a neurological perspective, comparing them just because they're both botanical is, well, it's like comparing a cup of coffee to a glass of whiskey just because they're both liquids you pour into a glass, you know? They
Yeah.
send your brain in entirely opposite directions.
Which brings us to the core mission of today's deep dive. We are looking at this brilliant article from the July 11th, 2026 edition of the OOTW Journal. It's titled Cannabis versus Psilocybin: How Two Different Neurochemical Systems Change the Brain.
It's a great piece. Very thorough.
It really is.
Yeah.
So our goal today is to show you why these two substances are actually physiological opposites operating in entirely different neural universes. Okay, let's unpack this.
Let's do it.
To really grasp how these plants alter your lived reality, we first have to look at the biological hardware they're hacking into, right?
Yeah, because it really is a story of two different keys opening two completely different doorways in your brain. So let's start with cannabis, specifically the psychoactive component, THC. THC operates through the endocannabinoid system, and this is a lipid signaling network, meaning it uses fat-based molecules, essentially, that your brain naturally uses to regulate its own activity. THC acts as what we call a partial agonist at the CB1 receptor.
Wait, I want to pause on that term, partial agonist, because it seems really important to the safety profile of the drug.
It is, yeah.
That essentially means it nudges the door open rather than like kicking it completely off the hinges, right?
That's a really good way to look at it. It activates the receptor, but only to a fraction of its maximum potential, which is a big reason why cannabis has a relatively forgiving safety margin regarding lethal overdoses, especially compared to things like synthetic opioids.
Right, that makes sense.
But the truly bizarre part of the endocannabinoid system isn't how it opens the door, it's the direction the messenger travels.
Right, because normally brain signals travel in one direction,
Yeah.
right? Like neuron A sends a chemical message across a gap to neuron B.
Exactly. A to B.
But the endocannabinoid system uses retrograde signaling, which means it travels backward. When I was reading the source material, I was trying to wrap my head around this, and I came up with an analogy.
Oh, I want to hear this.
Okay, so imagine a really busy nightclub. The sending neuron is the promoter outside letting people in.
Okay.
The chemical messengers are the people flooding into the club. And the receiving neuron is the club itself. Usually communication just flows straight into the club, but retrograde signaling is like the club gets way too full, so the bouncer inside walks backward out the front door, goes up to the promoter, and says, "Hey, shut it down. Stop letting people in."
I like that. That works as a baseline.
Okay.
But let's take your bouncer analogy a step further to really capture the neuroscience here.
Okay, hit me.
Imagine the bouncer doesn't just stop people at the door. He actually walks over to the DJ booth and unplugs the equipment to bring the energy of the whole room down.
Wait, so who is the DJ in this scenario?
The DJ represents neurotransmitters like GABA and glutamate. So GABA is your brain's primary inhibitory signal, the brakes. Glutamate is your primary excitatory signal, the gas pedal.
Okay, got it.
Your body's natural endocannabinoids are those bouncers. They are made on demand inside the receiving neuron. They drift backward across the synapse and they bind to the presynaptic CB1 receptors to tell that neuron to stop releasing GABA or glutamate.
So it's very targeted.
Highly targeted. It is a localized, precise, self-limiting volume knob. But when you introduce exogenous THC, you aren't just sending one bouncer to one club.
You're flooding every single club in the entire city with millions of fake bouncers all yelling to turn the music down at the exact same time.
Exactly. For hours, you are entirely overriding the brain's natural localized tuning system.
And that completely dictates the physical effects you feel. Like the source points out that these CB1 receptors are incredibly dense in the hippocampus, which is the brain region that handles short-term memory.
Right.
But they are very sparse in the brainstem, which controls automatic survival functions like your breathing. So That explains why cannabis reliably obliterates your short-term memory while you're high. But it virtually never suppresses your breathing to the point of a fatal overdose.
Yes, because you are dampening specific non-lethal circuits. Now, contrast that mechanism entirely with psilocybin.
Okay, let's switch gears.
First off, psilocybin is technically a prodrug.
Meaning the mushroom itself doesn't actually do anything.
Right. The mushroom doesn't make you trip. It's biologically inert until your liver metabolizes it, strips off a phosphate group, and turns it into the active molecule, which is psilocin. Since psilocin couldn't care less about the endocannabinoid system. Instead, it targets the serotonin system, specifically a receptor called the 5-HT2A receptor. And these receptors are densely packed on layer 5 pyramidal neurons in your cortex.
Whoa, pause there. Layer 5 pyramidal neurons sounds like a phrase completely designed to fail biology students.
Yeah, it's a mouthful.
In plain English, what part of the brain are we talking about here?
Fair enough. Think of the cortex as the executive suite of your brain. It's the highly evolved outer layer responsible for high-level cognition, sensory perception, and conscious thought.
The big boss area.
Exactly. The layer 5 pyramidal neurons are essentially the major output towers of this executive suite. They broadcast signals to the rest of the brain.
Okay, so if THC is a fake bouncer turning the volume down in the memory center, what is psilocin doing in the executive suite?
What's fascinating here is that psilocin flips the switch in the exact opposite direction. It does not dampen. It deeply excites.
Put that up.
Way up. When psilocin binds to those 5-HT2A receptors, it floods the cortex with signal and raises neural entropy.
Entropy, meaning chaos.
Well, in thermodynamics, entropy means chaos. But in neuroscience, it means your brain activity becomes radically less predictable, incredibly diverse, and hyperconnected in ways it normally isn't.
Wow.
And as entropy rises, it acutely loosens and destabilizes a network called the default mode network, or the DMN.
The DMN, which is essentially the biological seat of your ego, right? It's that tightly coupled brain circuit that runs your background self-talk, like your worries about tomorrow, your regrets about yesterday.
Exactly that. It's the filter through which you experience the narrative of you. Psilocybin forces that highly rigid network to temporarily fall apart and desynchronize.
So cannabis quiets and blurs the lines, while psilocybin actively destabilizes and reorganizes the entire network.
That's a perfect way to summarize it.
But let's bring this down to earth for a second. If we have one substance that turns the brain's volume down and another that shatters your ego, how does that pharmacological difference actually feel to you, like physically? Let's start with cannabis.
Well, the lived experience, the phenomenology, perfectly tracks with the pharmacology here. Because THC turns down the release of those neurotransmitters, the immediate effect is typically relaxation, a reduction in nausea, heightened appetite, and a warping of your perception of time, alongside that impaired ability to form new memories we talked about.
Wait, I have to stop you there. We constantly hear this pervasive cultural narrative that cannabis is just this harmless chill plant that helps everyone relax.
Oh, absolutely. It's everywhere.
But looking at the source material, it makes a massive point that cannabis is biphasic and highly dose dependent.
Yeah.
You're saying the actual data shows it predictably causes panic attacks. How does a chill drug do that?
It's all about the biphasic curve.
Meaning two phases.
Right. Biphasic means a drug has two entirely different phases of effects, depending on how much you take. At lower doses, cannabis can indeed dampen the nervous system enough to feel calming and reduce anxiety.
Okay, the chill phase.
Exactly. But if you push past that threshold into higher doses, it reliably provokes the exact opposite reaction, severe anxiety, paranoia, and acute panic.
Which is terrifying.
It is. And this biphasic reality is quietly colliding with the modern cannabis market. The flower people smoked back in the 1970s was maybe 3 or 4% THC. Today's commercial flower regularly sits at 20 to 28% THC. And if you look at concentrates or vapes, I mean, you are pushing 80 to 95% pure THC.
Not to mention the edible trap. If you're listening to this, there's a very good chance you or someone you know has fallen into the classic edible nightmare.
Oh, the classic trap.
You eat a gummy, you wait 45 minutes, you feel absolutely nothing, so you eat another one. And an hour later, you are hiding under your blanket, terrified of your own heartbeat. And the source explains that this isn't just bad luck, it's literal liver chemistry.
Yeah, the liver is the culprit here. When you inhale THC, it goes straight to the brain. But when you eat it, it passes through your digestive tract and into your liver first. Your liver enzymes attack that THC and convert a massive fraction of it into an entirely different secondary chemical called 11-hydroxy-THC.
And that one is stronger.
Much stronger. This molecule is highly psychoactive. It crosses the blood-brain barrier much more easily, and it hits you incredibly late, sometimes up to 2 full hours after ingestion. It produces a radically more potent, sometimes almost psychedelic level of intoxication that completely catches people off guard.
Now contrast that guessing game with the psilocybin experience. Because it excites the executive suite of the cortex and raises neural entropy, the subjective experience is categorically different.
Very different.
It's not a relaxant. You get profound visual and auditory changes, deeply intensified emotions, and intense introspection. And at high doses, because it breaks down that default mode network, you experience total ego dissolution, where the boundary between yourself and the outside world completely vanishes.
Yes, and the dosing reality in 2026 is structurally completely different for psilocybin. With modern psilocybin-assisted therapy, you aren't guessing with a 90% concentrate vape pen from a corner store.
Right, it's highly clinical.
Exactly. In these major clinical trials, it is administered in highly precise fixed doses, usually 25 milligrams of synthesized psilocybin. You have a very predictable onset of 20 to 40 minutes and a strictly defined arc that wraps up in 4 to 6 hours as your body clears the psilocin.
Which is so much more controlled.
It is. And this raises an important question. If these two substances alter your acute, momentary reality so profoundly, what happens to the structural integrity of your brain if you use them repeatedly?
Right. And this brings us to what I found to be the most jarring part of the source material. Again, society treats these two as interchangeable natural remedies. But when you look at dependence and addiction, their profiles are total mirror images.
They really are. Chronic, heavy exposure to THC literally forces your brain to physically adapt to survive. Remember those fake bouncers?
Yeah, flooding the clubs.
If you flood the clubs every single day, the brain realizes there's far too much inhibition happening. So it starts removing the locks on the doors, it downregulates and pulls those CB1 receptors back inside the cell where THC can't reach them.
It's essentially actively deleting its own receptors to maintain balance.
Yes. And that structural deletion produces genuine physical tolerance. You need more of the drug to get the same effect. And when you stop abruptly, those missing receptors create a very real withdrawal syndrome.
Like what kind of symptoms?
Severe irritability, intense insomnia, night sweats, and a total loss of appetite. The diagnosis for this in the DSM-5 is cannabis use disorder, or CUD. Based on data from the CDC, it currently affects roughly 3 out of every 10 people who use cannabis.
Wow.
And that risk skyrockets if you start using high-potency products daily or if you begin use during adolescence while the brain is still developing.
3 in 10 is a massive statistic. It completely shatters that it's just a plant, you can't get addicted narrative. So cannabis use removes receptors. But then you look at psilocybin, and it essentially has a built-in biological mechanism that structurally prevents you from taking it every day.
Right. It's a phenomenon called tachyphylaxis, which is the medical term for extremely rapid tolerance. After a single dose of psilocybin, your 5-HT2A receptors downregulate so aggressively and so quickly that if you try to take that exact same macrodose the very next day, you will feel almost nothing.
That is wild.
You physically cannot force the system to yield the same effect day after day. Because of this, psilocybin has an incredibly low dependence liability and absolutely no established physical withdrawal syndrome. Now, low dependence does not mean a drug is harmless, but on the specific axis of addiction, they are not even in the same universe.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting. Let's talk about the wellness buzzword of the decade, neuroplasticity.
Oh, neuroplasticity. It's everywhere.
Right. If you walk into a cannabis dispensary or look at the website for a psychedelic retreat, both industries are plastering this word all over their marketing. They both claim their plant rewires your brain for the better. But the source material is very careful to separate marketing hype from the actual clinical neuroscience.
Mm-hmm.
How do these two substances actually affect your brain's ability to change?
This is where we need total honesty about the preclinical data. Let's start with psilocybin. The case for psilocybin directly promoting neuroplasticity is incredibly strong. When given to mice in preclinical models, a single dose drives the rapid growth of brand new dendritic spines in the frontal cortex.
Dendritic spines being the tiny little branches on your neurons that reach out to form new connections with other neurons, right?
Exactly. They saw roughly a 10% increase in the density of these spines within just 24 hours of a single dose. And those new connections persisted for about a month.
In 24 hours.
Yeah, it's incredibly fast. It triggers this growth through a highly specific biological signaling cascade involving proteins called BDNF and MTOR.
Hold on, BDNF and MTOR, can we translate that into English? What are those proteins actually doing?
Sure. Think of BDNF, which stands for brain-derived neurotrophic factor, as miracle grow for your brain. It's the primary protein responsible for keeping neurons alive and helping them grow.
Okay, miracle grow.
And MTOR is essentially the cellular factory that reads the signal and starts building the new proteins to make the branches. Psilocybin cranks both the Miracle-Gro and the factory into overdrive.
That's amazing.
It is. This acute, massive burst of structural brain growth is currently the leading scientific theory for why psilocybin has such durable, long-lasting antidepressant effects long after the drug itself has completely left the patient's body.
Okay, so psilocybin throws Miracle-Gro on the executive suite. What about cannabis? Does THC grow new branches?
It touches plasticity, but from the completely opposite direction. We have to remember that your body's endocannabinoid system isn't just a volume nog. It is naturally a master regulator of synaptic plasticity.
So it's already running the show.
Right. It is supposed to be this finely calibrated, delicate tuning system that decides which connections to strengthen and which to prune. But when you flood those receptors with massive amounts of exogenous THC from a vape pen, you aren't enhancing that system. You are overwhelming and blunting it.
You're jamming the gears.
Heavy chronic exposure to high THC cannabis is actually associated with impaired plasticity and lagging cognition, particularly in developing adolescent brains. So yes, they both interact with the brain's plasticity networks, but psilocybin forces structural growth, while heavy cannabis use disrupts the brain's natural ability to tune itself.
So if we have one substance that turns the brain's volume down and can cause physical dependence, and another that forces rapid structural growth but temporarily shatters your sense of reality, how is a doctor in 2026 supposed to actually prescribe these? Let's look at the actual clinical scoreboard as it stands today.
Let's do it.
For cannabis, the hard medical data shows conclusive evidence for three main things: chronic pain management, chemotherapy-induced nausea, and multiple sclerosis spasticity. There was also a purified THC-free CBD medication called Epidiolex that the FDA approved for certain rare pediatric epilepsies. But the source highlights a massive caveat for everything else.
Yeah. And advocates might hate this, but the hard clinical data from 2026 is impossible to ignore. A massive systematic review and meta-analysis of over 50 randomized trials found absolutely no solid conclusive evidence that cannabis improves anxiety, depression, or PTSD in the long term.
Even though so many people use it for that.
Many people use it to self-medicate for those conditions, yes, but the clinical trials don't support it as a cure, and doctors have to weigh the risks. Aside from cannabis use disorder, emergency rooms are seeing rising cases of cannabinoid hyperemesis syndrome, which is a paradoxical condition where chronic use causes severe intractable vomiting.
That sounds awful.
It's brutal. Plus, there is a growing body of data linking heavy use to elevated cardiovascular events like arrhythmias. And perhaps most concerning for psychiatry, there is a hardening link between heavy, high-potency THC use and the earlier onset of psychotic disorders, particularly in young people with genetic vulnerabilities.
That's a huge risk profile. But then you flip the clinical scoreboard over to psilocybin, and it is actively leading the vanguard in psychiatry.
It is the clear front runner. The lead candidate, a synthesized psilocybin formulation known as CCOMP360, successfully completed two massive phase 3 clinical trials for treatment-resistant depression.
Which is notoriously hard to treat.
Extremely hard. The second trial, COMP006, involved hundreds of patients and met its endpoints early in 2026, showing that a single supervised dose provided a rapid and durable reduction in depression out to 26 weeks.
That's incredible. Half a year from one dose.
Because of this unprecedented success, the FDA actually began a rolling new drug application review for it in 2026. Beyond depression, twin trials showed sustained massive reductions in end-of-life anxiety for terminal cancer patients. And we are seeing incredibly promising pilot data for using psilocybin to treat alcohol use disorder and smoking cessation.
Which is incredibly telling. Addiction is an area where cannabis represents a clinical risk, but psilocybin is emerging as a candidate to treat addiction. Though, to remain totally objective, psilocybin comes with its own very serious risks. They're mostly psychological, highly challenging experiences, transient spikes in blood pressure during the session, and rare cases of HPPD, where perceptual visual changes persist for weeks or months.
Right, the visuals don't entirely stop.
And crucially, It is heavily contraindicated for anyone with a personal or family history of psychosis or bipolar disorder, because that massive spike in entropy can trigger prolonged manic or psychotic episodes.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, what we are looking at are two entirely different medical profiles. And this is why there are zero head-to-head clinical trials comparing cannabis to psilocybin. They aren't meant to do the same thing. They are entirely different tools built for entirely different jobs in the body.
Right.
And that biological reality is finally beginning to reflect in the 2026 legal landscape, even though it remains a total bureaucratic maze.
Let's lay out those legal facts just to report where we stand in 2026. The regulatory paths have completely diverged. Following major federal action, FDA-approved and state-licensed medical cannabis was historically downgraded to Schedule 3, recognizing its accepted medical use.
Finally.
However, recreational cannabis and all other marijuana remain firmly stuck in Schedule 9 while broader administrative hearings are still dragging on. So on the ground, cannabis is still this confusing state-by-state patchwork. Meanwhile, psilocybin remains Schedule 4th at the federal level across the board, with regulated therapeutic access only existing within very specific, heavily monitored state frameworks, namely Measure 109 in Oregon and Proposition 122 in Colorado.
And that legal divergence perfectly mirrors the neurological divergence we've spent this entire time unpacking. One substance is slowly being assimilated as a regulated, ongoing pharmaceutical tool for physical symptom management, while the other is being incredibly carefully shepherded as a highly specialized, episodic psychiatric intervention.
So what does this all mean? If you take away anything from this deep dive, it should be that this is not a competition between two plants. It is entirely a question of neural fit.
Neural fit, I like that.
Yeah. If you need immediate, ongoing daily relief for chronic physical pain or the nausea of chemotherapy, that is your endocannabinoid system doing what it evolved to do best, turning down the volume of the distress signal.
Right.
But if you are trapped in a rigid, deeply ingrained mental loop, like severe treatment-resistant depression or a debilitating addiction, and you need a single transformative intervention to completely break that loop, that is psilocybin temporarily desynchronizing your default network and forcing the growth of new connections.
We really have to move past the cultural habit of asking, well, which plant medicine is better? And start acting like precision scientists asking, what is the specific biological mechanism required to treat this specific type of suffering?
Which leaves us with a truly fascinating thought to mull over. The source points out that there are no head-to-head trials because they operate on completely different neurological hardware.
Yeah.
But if that's true, if our bodies are this mechanical, we have to ask ourselves, are we on the verge of a future where a quick functional brain scan will tell a doctor exactly which of your neural systems is out of balance?
That would change everything.
Imagine a world where medicine isn't about aimlessly guessing which natural plant from the garden makes you feel a little better, but mathematically matching the exact lock in your brain to the precise pharmacological key.
It's an amazing prospect.
It really is.
Mm-hmm.
Until then, keep asking questions and keep diving deep.